Thank you very much. Can everyone hear me all right if I do this and wander around? Very good. A couple of things. I should first, Wendy may know exactly how hard this is for me to do, but I have to first start by admitting that I was wrong when I gave the quote about the empty room thing, because a closet or a room full of books is still a closet, and an empty room with a librarian serving their community is a library. So I don't think that will assuage many of the folks that didn't like that quote to begin with, but we'll go there. I also have to say it's very difficult giving a presentation in Canada because you guys are just so nice. It's always, you know, you need a little tension when you're going to speak. You need to be a little on edge, and we had a glorious tour. Can you get this water? Can we, you know, get you a phone? Whatever it is, it's just, it's not good. So, as an American, please feel free to abuse me on a regular basis, and because God knows we do that to everyone else. Also, throughout here, if you have questions, you don't have to say them. We'll certainly set some time apart, but if you want to ask a question or a challenge, that's the time to do it. We have a very inelegant saying in the United States about calling certain things, so we'll call it calling shenanigans. So if we go through this and you go, no, don't feel like you have to hold that to yourself. Share it with all of us. So today I would like to talk about expecting more from our libraries and our communities. It's very interesting that where this comes from is I had a former student who became a director of an academic library, and she went in with the mandate of change this library. And she looked around and she said, this library is not good. All the staff look down or they're in their office, and you know, it's dark and it's dank and it's bad. And so she then, like, you know, looking to get the support, pulled students aside and said, tell me what you think of the library. And the student said, it's fine. It's great. If they could use more power, if they could have more outlets, that would be fine. And she was really sort of taken aback by this, going, no, it stinks. Tell me it sucks. This is horrible. And the student was just like, nah, it's fine. What she encountered, I think, is what a lot of us encounter, which is when we ask our communities, what should the library become? What should librarians do? The response, by and large, from our community is, I don't know. Or, well, yeah, you're fine. We talk about being loving libraries to death. Oh, I love libraries, yeah? Oh, love them, love them, love them. You ever go? Not so much. and particularly you're a public library. I mean, you folks, you know, first of all, you're reading all day in mahogany-filled rooms. I think some of you still wear smoking jackets to work. But, you know, it's this... It actually, when you think about those examples, it's not their fault because it's not their job, right? You ask someone, what should a library do? What's the future of libraries? It's not about us. It's not about libraries. They don't spend their time worrying about us. And secondly, it's not their job. And it's not our job to necessarily worry about what the library thinks the future is. Our job is to see what they're into. What's their problems? What's their needs? What their dreams? What their aspirations are? And so a lot of this is talking about librarianship as a way of inviting the community into this future discussion. And that's where this expect more theme came from, which is we really need, in many cases, our communities to expect more of us. Because if they don't, then when we suddenly start doing things that don't fit their mental models, that's when friction occurs, right? So I went by a delightful makerspace with 3D printed things. What's that doing in a library, right? The compact shelving, I get, you know, because one, it's hilarious to watch people try and trap each other in it, right? That's just amusing. But, you know, a 3D printer, and what's this about scanning? And, you know, what is that doing in the library? Now, in many cases, if you have a big enough community, probably in Toronto, people let it slide as long as you're doing the other stuff. But in smaller communities, it's really become a rather interesting debate about why is this in a library, which leads to a rather uncomfortable conversation about what is a library, which leads to a rather uncomfortable conversation about why didn't you know? So we're going to spend some time talking about expecting more. one, expecting more of ourselves and expecting more of our communities. But that's a rather old line, and frankly, we're all a little tired of it. If we hear that more with less crap one more time, you will leave and I will lead you out, all right? You know, I've been looking at the austerity situation in the UK and Europe as they're closing public libraries, where they're saying, keep the library open, for goodness sake, we'll just have volunteers staff it because that will be just as good. Right? That's not what we're talking about. What we're talking about is if we can raise the expectations of our community, and in doing so, raise our expectations of what we do to serve that community, we also must raise our expectations of the community to support what we're doing. So this isn't about more with less. This is about more to get more, and more and what our objectives are. So since we're in Quoteville, I'll give you another one. This was outside of the Fairfield Public Library. Whoop, I'm going to go back. Bad libraries build collections. Good libraries build services. Great libraries build communities. So this one is another one of those do we agree or not agree sides. And this was the idea that you go, but we build collections. They're important. We've got stuff. I just spent a great tour looking at great stuff. And so people, if you've read the Atlas, one comment I get regularly from that book is, you called them artifacts. Like I injured someone's child by calling them an artifact. Yeah. You called books artifacts. They're not artifacts. They're books. And I'm like, and they're great, and I love them, but I really love you more. In special collections in Syracuse University, our special collections librarians have what they call the fire book. It's the one that they would run back into the burning building to save. You know, and we have this beautiful Galileo folio, and oh, I would run in to get that. Which one would you run into, Dave? I'd run in to get you. You know, it's like, sorry, Galileo, but this person's still breathing. Leave her out. Those collections, those materials, as we're going to hit over and over again, are not unimportant. And I don't want you to walk away today feeling like, why do we take up the room with this useless stuff? That's not the point. The point is that they are tools and instruments for us to do our true work. And so the idea, for example, of services is collections, materials, thoughts, processes, librarianship in action. And if you think about it, a lot of what we used to call just a collection is really a service. If you have taken the collection of books and materials that you have purchased and you have put them in an order, you have provided a service. If you have made them available for circulation, you have provided a service. If you have highlighted certain ones, you've provided a service. If you do translation, service is not to say instead of, but on top of normally collections. We found this out when we were doing a research project for the National Science Foundation in the US, where we were going to build the National Science Digital Library. And it was going to be a beautiful library that would save humanity as we know it, because all of K-12 education could see what a calcium atom looked like when you spun it around. It was going to be great. And so they started by giving out two funding sources. The first funding source was for people interested in collection building. So here's money, go build collections. They built things like 3D models of chemicals. They built simulations. They built manuscript collections, they digitized things, they did Born Digital. The second stream, they gave all this money for people to build library services. So they built organizational schema, visualization search services, etc. And then at the 3-year mark, they said, now, come together. Right? So all the people building the collections, just send them in to us, and the service people will organize them, search against them, and whatever. And the collection people suddenly went, what do you mean send them in to you? And we said, well, put them on a drive. And they said, yeah. Well, would you like to know how we're organized? And they're like, oh, you weren't supposed to organize things because that's a service. And they're like, so what did you want? Ones and zeros randomly assorted? This idea of service is not disconnected from a collection. A collection is a service. Reference is a service. Job finding is a service. Public access is a service. Having a building and a roof above your head is a service. But great libraries understand the reason we're doing all of that is for a community to get better. That without community involvement, without community engagement, without community assessment, without community impact, why are we here? So that's what this quote came from. Bad libraries build collections, good libraries build services, great libraries build communities. And we're going to spend a good amount of time today talking about how we do that in probably a different way. So it is ultimately not the size of our collection, but the reach of our community that really matters. There are teeny tiny itty bitty libraries that do brilliant work for their communities, and there are massive, amazing, huge libraries that do a horrible job. And what it comes down to is, why are we here and what are we doing? And that's where we're going to talk about the reach of our community. So my agenda for the day is we're going to start a little bit with what is a library. Oh God, help me, no. Library School 101, yep. But we have to do it, because I would argue that we sort of have lost our way a bit. We're going to talk about the true library collection. Then we're, hopefully before the break, maybe after the break, we're going to get to some collection development exercises. And finally talk about new skills that we as librarians need, which I think will fit into the agenda that we're looking at. So let's start with what is a library and the problems of definition. So we all know what a library is. It's in the United States, there's an old saying, which is, you know, whatever it is like pornography. We know it when we see it. And in a public library, we see it all too often. So here's what Oxford thinks the Oxford English Dictionary tells us a library is. We're going to go ahead and excuse the idea of a series of books or the idea of a room with a private house. We'll give them that. Software is a library. They're welcome to borrow our term. But I would point you to the first two as being pretty problematic. That a building or room containing a collection of books, periodicals, and sometimes films and recorded music for people to read, borrow, and refer to, such as a school library. Right? A collection of books and periodicals held in a library. So why is that problematic? Because, you know, that doesn't sound too bad. That's kind of what we do. So the first question I have for you is comes down to that books, periodicals, sometimes films and recorded music, and a room to house them. Because if that's the definition of a library, this is a library. Some of you have experienced this. This is the book sale. Some of you have been the cause of this. This is the book sale. This is the example that in many libraries in the States, and I'm sure this doesn't happen in Canada, all the retired librarians become part of the Friends of the Library so they can capture the weeded books and bring them back in the bookstore. But, you know, it's a library, right? Look, they've got books and signs, and it's definitely a room. So is this what we want to consider a library? And if you say, no, come on, Dave, what we really mean is stop. Because once again, let's work with the definition that folks have. When we were working with the Free Library of Philadelphia and they were getting ready for their expansion of their main branch, this was a once-in-a-century activity, they said, you know, when they built this Beaux-Arts building on Logan Circle back in the turn of the century, it was a temple of books. It was the books. That was the resource and main reason to be there. This is not what we want to be, the temple of books, because I'll tell you, this is a slippery slope. Because if you begin defining libraries like this, you end up going here very quickly. So this person, you go, oh, good, someone who loves books and magazines. And then you look behind him and you go, is that his kitchen table? And then, oh, my God, that's his house. That's a diagnosed hoarder. That's correct. The difference between a hoarder and a librarian is librarians use canvas bags. I've been to the American Library Association. I haven't been to the Super Conference recently, but I've seen you guys on the floor. And you go, well, you're even looking at this going, well, that's not that bad, I guess. But then, you know, this is the next step, right? And they wouldn't let me go in the basement. But I'm guessing somewhere you got a room in this system that looks remarkably like this. No, absolutely not. Right? So this isn't what we want to be. The problem with the definition of a place with stuff is non-exclusive, and it doesn't indicate the real value of service, and as we'll get to, collection, right? And it also, the problem with this definition is it doesn't take into account the things we do want to include as libraries desperately that don't fit into this, right? So a building room containing collections of books, periodicals, sometimes film and recorded music, and in the case of this library, body parts. Right. This is the Onondaga County Community College, and this is their library, and they loan out body parts because they have health tech and biology courses and medical courses. And yes, if you look really close, you can see their dissected cat in glass. It's very, really frightening, but I'm sorry for the cat lovers. It's there. All right. I will tell you it's not a recent acquisition. And it had no tire tracks in it. So this we want to talk about. You know, I was dog person. All right. I was just up in special collections, and you have brilliant things that don't fit that nice little recording, right? Syracuse, we have a Belfer Audio Lab. We have amazing, the original cylinders that Edison recorded on, and that now the only way they can get the music off it is with laser scopes to recreate the music so they don't destroy the cylinders. We have amazing collections. In New York City, they have a library of building materials attached to a school of architecture. When an architect is coming to make decisions about different surfaces and building materials, this is their collection. It's not a recording book-like music, right? And we can go further. This is one of my other favorite services. You probably have done something along it. These are the human libraries. Or this is a system that was going through Europe. They called it the prejudice library, where people could check out a prejudice. Have you talked to someone who's a Muslim? Have you talked to someone who's a Jew? Have you talked to someone who's black? Have you talked to someone, you know, go through the list. And the idea being, why is this a library? Well, jumping ahead, because this is a safe civic space. One of my favorite parts of a definition of a library is a safe place to engage dangerous ideas, right? And so this is a library. We want to include this because ultimately, if the library is part of a solution that allows our communities to be more diverse, more understanding, more opening, more able to deal with incoming solutions, then that's good. We want that with a library, but that's not a place with books and recordings. Right? We love in the United States talking about being the melting pot. And it's always, I've always, always, always loved coming up to Canada, which is the mosaic approach. And we used to think we won until we realized that not everyone likes being melted, right? Not that everyone likes being slapped in a place with glue, but you know, you can work with me. Right? But this idea of a place where people reside, where communities get better, where they learn, where they heal. This is something we want to include in that definition. And then my other favorite library looks like this. In Kenya, they're building public libraries as fast as they can. In the cities, they're popping up on a regular basis. Where they can't get good transportation to, they have built donkey carts taking 1,000 books at a time into the outback. And where it's even too remote for the donkeys, in the northern tribal area, they send camels. So what you're looking at is the library, and what the other part of the library you can't see because they're holding the line is the librarian that brings them in, and they unpack the materials, they set up tents, they set up mats, they sit and they work on literacy, and they teach parents how to teach kids, and they teach reading, and they bring a whole set of services and such. The camel is the most essential animal and resource that many of these tribes have. It's labor. When it's expired, it becomes dinner. When it's done with its dinner, the outcome becomes fuel for their stoves. And now it's become essential because it is about knowledge and learning and training. This is a library. But it doesn't fit that definition. That definition is a problem. We need a better sense of that. And you say, once again, sort of 101-ish, okay, 101 for my next trick. what do we need to include here? We need to begin to define a library not by its place and its architecture. We begin to need to define it by what it does and who does it. A room full of books is a closet. An empty room with a librarian serving their community is a library. Will they build a collection of websites? Probably. Physical items? Probably. Will those be books? Maybe. But the point is, they'll be doing it in response to a community's need to learn. So our definition becomes a mandated, mediated space owned by the community, stewarded by librarians, and dedicated to knowledge. It's a bit wordy, but let me walk you through it for a moment. Mandated. You can't have a library that's, in essence, an unwelcome development. Right? Whether that's through a tax vote, whether that's through some sort of structure, there's been some means that says we need that, a charter, a budget line, whatever it is. So the mandate, we have this idea that says thou art a library. And that doesn't come from us, that's a definition, a mandate that comes from our communities. Mediated. It's not simply a pile that we're dumping things into. It takes time to mediate access. Now, we're going to go through a lot about what I mean by mediated in a moment. That doesn't mean librarian in your face all the time. When people walk into this building, mediation has already occurred. You've picked hours. You've picked what's open and what's not. You've picked a layout. Where you put the computers is very telling. Where you put the compact shelving is very telling. Where you put things and how you arrange them and who gets where and why and when, that's mediation and that's the work of a librarian. Right? You could say it's the work of the architects, but we know architects are from the devil. We know that good architecture takes a lending to what is the community doing, what they're doing. Architecture is amazing. Talking with architects and designers, they've moved from the world of building buildings to building spaces. And what they mean is we design the empty space in the middle and then put the walls around it. So they spend a huge amount of time looking at flow, looking at workflow, looking at community types, looking at what they're doing, confidential space, non-confidential space, the same thing that we do. And hopefully when we build a library, together. Right? So mediated space. And a space here being virtual or physical or both. We need, as librarians, to stop thinking of our online presence as and. We have a library. And, right? That is a library. In fact, that's a more accessible library to many people than this building or the other 98 buildings in the system. When people come online, what mediation do they get? Now, I'll give you a hint, just as a task. Spend some time and do a little policy audit, right? So take your policies on when we're allowed to kick someone out of a library and look at it. I'm guessing that policy is a lot about how to be a good community member. Don't be too loud, don't be disruptive, don't, right? It's all about how do you work together. Now look at your policies for online and how many of them start with, you're gonna be a thief if you steal this or if you do this in an unauthorized way. It's one, accusatory, and two, it's all about the individual. How much collaboration can people do through your online site? So many times it's like, you gotta be on Facebook, man. Library's gotta have a Facebook page. Well, really? What do you do on Facebook? We put every announcement on our Facebook page. Really? Does anyone ever comment on your announcement? No, no one ever sees our announcement. It's not radically different than the people who post every lunch they've eaten. I get it. But the notion here is the community, the feedback. Have you ever gone to Facebook and asked people what they want and seen what it's like and all these kinds of things, right? So we have to think of our online as mediated spaces just as much as our physical presence. Is it presences or presence-i? Presences. That's what, Latin or Greek or German. Anyway, owned by the community. Owned by the community. What the amazing trend that we're seeing now is that it used to be that the library was the space for the librarian to do their work and we invited the community into it. We now understand that this is the community space where often we're kicking the librarians out of it. where librarians are using this as a touch point and then leaving to go into community groups, moms groups, business groups, schools, etc. And we're embedding more and more librarians within the community, and this becomes a tool to get work done, but a tool for the community to get work done as well. Stewarded by librarians. Now, I'm going to give you a sort of one of the conclusions early. I believe that there are three ways to become a librarian. The first, and of course most important because it pays my bills, is through a Master's of Library Science accredited by the American Library Association, preferably gotten at Syracuse, but since I'm in Toronto, I won't mention that. And it's great. And there's lots of reasons, and I believe in it. That's why I teach in it. The second way is that you get hired with the title of librarian. And it would be insane to pretend that that doesn't exist. In Vermont, a state in the United States, they have lots of I just thought I'd add that. I don't know how parochial you Toronto people are. God knows. That's like I'm from the United States. Like, to me, Canada's not just big hockey rinks and beer. All right, no. Don't throw things. It was a joke. The second is that they get hired at a library. In Vermont, there are many directors of libraries that never get a library science degree because that job could never pay the financial debt of getting the degree. There also tend to be librarians and postmasters and town clerks and whatever in small communities. And what state libraries in Vermont and Maine have done is they've done brilliant outreach and education and continuing education to bring those folks along. Third way is being born as a librarian, right? The spirit of a librarian. You have that. This, and I'm not talking about the people who organize the books on their nightstand. That's not what I mean. It's those people who get it, who get the idea of this is more than just stuff and this is more than just a place, that it really is the idea of access and reaching out to a community, and we see them all the time. And I think it's ridiculous if Bill Gates tomorrow, as he did with the Gates Foundation, said we want to invest in libraries, for us to go, oh, no, you're not a librarian. He's Bill Gates. Let him take the title and give you the check, right? We have people. We need to constantly recruit civil librarians on a regular basis so that they begin invested in our future and our success. And dedicated to knowledge. And that's the big one, right? We seek to improve our communities not in every way, but in very specific ways. This is not the place to come and get free food. This is not the place to come and look at dinosaur bones. This is not the place. This is the place where we look at knowledge as our primary instrument to advancing our communities. And that is a very special and very amazing philosophy. And it's one that throughout North America has a different background than in many other parts of the world. In the United States, the public library movement began simultaneously and concurrently with the public education movement. The public library was seen as a co-educational institution to the public school. Kids went to school, adults and people who couldn't go to school went to the library, but it was all about learning. It wasn't all about preservation of cultural heritage. It wasn't all about keeping the old materials. It was about learning. And so in Middle Ages and Dark Ages, cities used to build grand cathedrals to get pilgrims and to get the attention and to become an important city. We don't build cathedrals anymore. We build libraries. And that's not a minor statement when you look at San Francisco, when you look here, when you look at Seattle, when you look at Vancouver, they built the buildings as a cathedral. They built it as a shrine to knowledge to say, we are an informed community, we invest in education, we are important, come here, look here, pay attention here. That's important. But let us get back to what we were really talking about. Now that we can define it, we understand that buildings, books, there we go, buildings, books, and databases, they're just tools. Like a scalpel to a surgeon, those tools may change, but the profession remains. And that's what's really important. How many people have watched the arc of library stories in the popular press? You're going, maybe, what? Turn of the century. Articles were, do we need libraries? Are libraries obsolete? Will libraries go extinct? Has Google destroyed libraries? Oh my God, here comes the asteroid, we're going to die. Not so much the last part, but definitely the first part. And then what happened is, like, around 2008, 2009, all the reporters decided to show up, I guess, to celebrate the bonfires. And they walked into their libraries and they found something really amazing, which is they were still there and they were crowded. And they went and said, something's different here. Have you ever lost a lot of weight? I've gained a lot, but I've lost it too. It's one of these, right? But you lose a lot of weight, you walk into a room, and people are like, oh, what have you done to your hair? And you're like, I've lost it, but this I lost too, right? So these reporters would look around, and they're going, something's different. I can't put on. And you know what they would find? Librarians with tattoos. There is a whole genre of articles on tattooed librarians, right? You guys have lived through them, and you're almost feeling like, well, I don't have one, but I'm here, right? Remember when tattoos were a sign of, like, resistance against parental involvement, and now it's like extra babysitting money on a weekend? What the hell is that about? All right. Anyway, what happened was that the libraries and librarians turned to the community and said, what do you need, what do you need, what do you need, what do you need, and started doing it. Oh, you need public access computing. Oh, you need help with finding jobs. Oh, you need story time. Oh, you need... And they began to craft themselves around the communities instead of being generic cookie-cutter systems. And now the articles that are starting to come out are like, hey, Knowledge Center. Hey, libraries are cool. Libraries are doing interesting things. Right? We're still librarians. It's kind of like saying, what's a farmer? Right? You can say a farmer has a pretty long history. You know, back to, I'm tired of chasing those stupid saber-toothed cats, I'm going to plant wheat. Right? That's about the lineage we can go back to with farmers. And yet, a farmer today, comparing themselves to a farmer from even 100 or 200 years ago, radically different people. They're dealing with gene-modified crops, they're dealing with combines, they're dealing with circulation, you know, where they're rotating crops, and they're dealing with how do you replenish it, they deal with all of this stuff, and yet, they're still farmers. They still have a kinship to that history. And as librarians, even though we may be looking at online databases and 3D printers, which we'll get to in a bit, we're still librarians. Those tools that we use to inform our communities, to improve and increase the learning of our communities, they're going to change. But we're still librarians. I think one of the times I oftentimes get resistance from librarians when you start talking about different services because they're like, oh, that's not why I became a librarian. And why did you become a librarian? And it's rarely, rarely to catalog books, of course. Yeah. I mean, come on. Every so often there is the, because I was good at crossword puzzles. Oh, dear God. Like, I had that English major, and then, anyway. They became to do a difference. Every librarian I know that's worth their salt has within them the story, right? This is the story about when you done did good. This is that story that you take out when they come up and ask, have you seen a USB drive? This is that story when they come and say, I think the men's room needs some attention. This is that story when you're in the middle of changing toner cartridges going, why am I doing this? That you take back and say, because that one time when that kid came and said, I found the perfect book and glows for an hour and a half about what it is. That one time when I can talk about a man who came in every day in a suit and tie until I finally found out he had lost his job. I put out a coffee pot. Librarian, director of Maine's, former direct state librarian of Maine, she had a situation. The gentleman would come in every day, suit and tie, and they would come into the library. And they'd been laid off. She took the rec room, it's a small library she worked in at the time, she took the rec room and she cleared it out and she put a coffee pot and tables into it and put, I think, a sign over it that went, in essence, the business area. And those gentlemen came in every day and they went into the business area. And eventually they got jobs. They came back and they said, thank you. You made me feel important. Those stories never start with, and they reached for the book I had cataloged with tremulous hands, right? That's what makes you a librarian. Why do we collect books? Because if you say we're a book people, you suck at it. I'm sorry to use my English
American English on you. But this is how you do not take care of a book. Buy it, wrap it in plastic, and put stickers on it and let people take it home to God only knows what, right? That's not being a book, people. That's not what they're there for. They're there for the people. I mean, I'm sure there was a debate in the Library of Alexandria when they were moving from clay tablets to scrolls. The portable technology of the day.
Yes, but how long would that battery last? I mean, mine's done in centuries. Yours is only done in decades, right?
Yeah, this, right? They're just tools. And we hold the value. I came up with this because I said something like, librarians are, regardless of the tools they use, and this guy said, well, what, a doctor without a scalpel is pretty useless. And I said, yeah, but when that scalpel becomes the laser scalpel, or these days, if you've had as many procedures as I have, becomes literally a camera being stuck in your body to move things, I still want a doctor doing that. It's not the camera that makes them medically able to do this, right? Those tools change. You may have become a librarian and learned on, you know, you can recite MARC codes in your sleep. You may have become, when the days when you could, you know, it's the desk set days. By the way, you'll be horrified to know that my current library students have no idea what desk set is. Spencer Tracy, Catherine Hepburn, really? I gotta show you. So anyway, right? Does anyone, first of all, we should make this an interactive session. How many people know about Desk Set, the movie? I see film on next Thursday. There's this great, so Spencer Tracy, this will only take an hour. Spencer Tracy is called in as a process consultant, and he studies the reference library at a newspaper, at a magazine, a newspaper, I believe it was. And the idea that Katharine Hepburn's the head of librarians, she has four other librarians who work for it, so the reporter calls up, asks a question, they have a reference, they're ready to run and give him the answer, right? Spencer Tracy comes in, examines it, and they put in, a computer, right? Yeah, but, you know, this is the days, das blinken lights computers with the spinny tapes, right? And so they bring in a computer, and they fire the librarians. But it's okay. Spencer Tracy didn't know, and he was really offended when it happened. But because he's in love with Katharine Hepburn. And it's, anyway, so there's this story where this poor computer operator takes a call from a reporter, and the reporter wants to know about the island of Corfu. And so she types it in. And so she goes to take, the dialogue occurs, questions happen. Suddenly the computer starts spitting out ream after ream of paper. And Spencer Tracy goes, Miss, I forget what her name is. What is this? He goes, oh, it's Corfu. Catherine Hepburn goes, oh, no. That's Curfew. And it's the epic 80 stanza poem about curfew shall not ring tonight. And the best part is she like picks it up on like stanza 50 and starts reciting it from memory. This was the idea that librarians knew everything, right? And so we don't know everything anymore. And so we became librarians. We moved from this idea that we knew everything to we could find everything. And my least favorite saying ever, you know, there's no better search engine than a librarian, is crap. You guys are not search engines. You don't do a good job of it. You don't distort results for advertising. You don't spit back 50,000 results in 10 milliseconds. And you don't trap people into potentially invalid information. You're not a search engine. That's not your value. Kim Silk, a colleague at University of Toronto, was talking to my librarians, and she mentioned the idea of how wonderful Google was here because it could handle all the document delivery crap that we didn't have to deal with anymore. Where's a good pizza place? I don't know. Where's a good pizza place? I mean, you know, has anyone ever had the situation where your doctor does that?
Well, Mr. Lankes, it looks like you have... cancer. So, longer story.
All right. So, this idea that we have the value here and that our tools will change. Our tools have already changed. We'll get to more on that. But I want to start with a few things, which is to get much further, we have to go to this word, because this is the word that's even more problematic than the word library. So, pop quiz, hopefully. Come on, there we go. Which is knowledge? both. This hurts me because that's my book, too. All right. Who says both? Who says rock? All right. Who says my book? You. Thank you. Thank you so much. It was a pity raise, and I'll take it. And the answer, of course, is neither. Neither. And you sit there and go, oh, no, no, no. Yeah, that rock's much more valuable than your book. Trust me, it's knowledge. Right? So we go into things like, well, wait a minute. You know, this is semantically interesting, and it has text that we can read and we can absorb, etc. This actually has semantic. This is for anyone know where this rock is from?
Australia, I guess.
Nope. It is actually from, because someone mentioned before, that, and Andrew Lloyd Price. Who's the architect? Frank Lloyd Wright, thank you. Too many three-name people. Frank Lloyd Wright, he had a wonderful workshop out in Arizona, in Scottsdale. This is on his, he built the deck around this rock. And it's an ancient rock, and it has Indian inscriptions, Native American inscriptions on it. And so it also has semantic data. But what's interesting is, a geologist can look at this rock and they can tell you what kind of rock it is, how old this rock is, where it came from. An anthropologist could look at the importance of the Native American symbols and talk about what the representation was. You can learn a lot. But the rock isn't the knowledge. The anthropologist brings it to it. The geologist brings it to it. It's our knowledge. This is what's sparking it or creating or studying it, but it's our knowledge. If you don't read English, this is not a very helpful book. I mean, we can debate whether it's helpful anyway. But if you don't read English, it's not a very helpful book. It was translated into Italian. I cannot tell you how hilariously fun it is, and I mean that not at all, to be debating with Italian scholars through Google Translate, right? Book, good, no? Right? So it's fun. Anyway, but the idea being, what do you need to get out of here? You need language, you need to know how to read, you need to know how to understand, you need to have a comprehension. It was written for librarians. Many people said it's still incomprehensible. But the idea, the greatest review of this book was the Finnegan's Wake of our era. You know, on one hand, you got to say, wow, I'm being compared to famous authors. The other one is like stream of consciousness that takes no sense. Yeah, all right. This isn't knowledge, right? Knowledge is uniquely human. We have knowledge. It's what tells us how to act. It's what affects our behavior. It's what we believe. Philosophers in the room, give me a break for a moment. We'll get into constructivism later. There's a microphone. It'll be fun. We'll talk Heidegger. But for now, it's what we believe, right? So when you hear things like, it's 20 degrees outside, you guys say, summer. I say, damn, it's cold, right? Context matters, right? How you learn, what you know, it all affects it. When you're coming up here, what do you know, et cetera. I had, we got married, my wife and I, that's who we got married to. My wife and I, we got married in Rybrook, New York, which is about 40 minutes north of New York City. And my lovely, lovely, lovely aunt and uncle who live in, I'm not making this name up, Lynchburg, Virginia. You would think you would change the name after a certain amount of time. But anyway, Lynchburg, Virginia, said, oh, we can't come. New York City's too scary. And I said, we're not in New York City. We're in Rybrook. Oh, no, it's New York. I mean, like, the entire state is like, you know, and if you live in New York, the entire state is, you know, the Empire State Building and that stuff, right? But this idea of how you understand the world, when you come, the anticipation, what you're going to believe, what you're not going to believe, what your value system, who you're going to listen to, who you're not going to listen to, all of that is your knowledge, and it's unique not only to being human, but it's unique to you. This is the idea that we are in the knowledge business. We're in the human thinking business, right? To grow knowledge is not a process of acquisition. We don't buy knowledge, we don't subscribe to knowledge, we don't shelve knowledge, we don't digitize knowledge. We do that to stuff and artifacts, and they're important tools, but they're there for a reason, which is we are here to help people learn. So you're educators. As librarians, you're educators. You are in the learning, you are not a teacher, We'll get there in a moment. But you're an educator. Why not a teacher? Go ahead and use teacher if you want, but it has a lot of baggage to it. You're not in a sort of established curriculum. You don't have this sort of force-fed idea of what you're going to teach. You are inquiry-driven. You let the community direct and self-direct their learning. So you're educators, but in a very unique setting. And that means you're about learning. The purpose of the library, then, is about learning. Right? Learning is done through conversation. Right? Well, I don't know. Right? So this is where we lose the other half. What do you mean learning through conversation? I talk to stupid people all the time. Mostly myself. Right? So what does it mean learning through conversation? But have you ever been in a conversation with a stupid person where you didn't know they were a stupid person till like 5 minutes into it, and then they say something and you're like, oh, thanks. Gotta go. Oh, boy. Yeah, Ice Age is coming. Anyway, did you know, by the way, in the state of Florida, it is now illegal in government documents to use the phrase climate change? Yeah.
What?
It's not even in your country. They vote for my president, people. This is where, right? So, you go, I didn't learn anything from that conversation. That is not true. You learned not to have another conversation with that person, right? That's learning. We do that all the time. Whenever, I mean, the best learning occurs in the worst disasters, right? For example, did you know that the water pressure going into your toilet's pretty high? You know how you learn this? When you break the back of the toilet, the water's shooting up, and you're going, Han, turn off the water, right? You didn't learn the thing you wanted to, but you learned. We learn through conversation. Conversations can occur between people, between groups of people, between societies, all the time. We would like, for example, in America, to learn the idea of universal health care. Just an idea, right? This idea of conversations, but most and the vast majority of the conversations we have to learn are with ourselves. We talk to ourselves, sometimes out loud. But if you just sat there and went, what is he talking about? Who were you talking to? If you ever been to that situation where you're like ready to leave in the morning, you're like, if I go that way, I get the good bagel. If I go that way, I get the good coffee, and you do this. Right? You're having a debate with yourself. We do this all the time. Should I take that job offer? Should I take the trip? Should I buy this? Should I not buy this? Those are intrinsic conversations. We have them all the time. Do I believe it? Do I not believe it? And this doesn't just happen when we're sitting thinking out loud. It happens when we do things like, here's a wacky idea, read. Because you're not having a conversation with the book. It's either a bits on a screen or it's dead trees. They don't make good conversationalists. Right? And you're not having a conversation with the author, particularly if you're reading Shakespeare, because that would be a neat trick. Right? You're having a conversation with yourself. Do I believe it? Do I understand? When you're doing math and you learn 2 plus 2 equals 4, there's part of you that sort of says, oh, does it? You know, let's try that one. Right? And that's why we learn not just from nonfiction and encyclopedias and journal articles and all this. We learn from fiction. We learn from plays. We learn from poetry. We learn from art. The book that sort of changed my life, right? That's the other thing people tend to have. My name is Asher Lev. I was a junior in high school. Now, if you know anything about Chaim Potok's My Name is Asher Lev, a white, you know, Episcopal kid from the suburbs learning about a Jewish artist in the Orthodox community in Brooklyn, maybe that's a leap, but I was the art geek. And suddenly I was reading about another art geek. And suddenly I said, I'm not alone. I'm not crazy. I learned. It changed how I understood myself. Those conversations. So when we have these delightful terminals and books and materials, gorgeous maps, amazing artifacts from Canadian history and American history and world history, it's for us, they're stimulating conversations. When you look out at your stacks, what you should see is not an amazing collection of knowledge. It's not. What you should see is not an amazing array of artifacts. You should see kindling. And I know, burning books sounds like a really scary concept, but the fire you're lighting is not of the books, it's of the mind. Every one of those has the potential to take someone in a whole new world, to give someone a new perspective on the world. Whether it's literature, whether it's just talking to someone who read the book, whatever it is, whether it's movies. And so this idea, though, that learning only happens through books, why do we have 3D printers here? Because we learn by building, we learn by making. Why are we letting people do podcasting? Because they feel powerful and it gives them a sense of self-worth and it engages them in a dialogue with the rest of the people who listen. Why are we doing author series? Because they learn what it is to be a reader and a writer. And why do we bring these human libraries in? Because they learn what it means to be in a diverse community. Because it's all about learning. Not about the stuff, not about the shelves, not about the architecture. Those are important, vital tools to the objective, not the objective. A mandated, mediated space, owned by the community, stewarded by librarians, and dedicated to knowledge. How do we mediate this space? We're moving to interactivity, I promise. Stick with me. Well, there are four basic ways in which we as librarians, four primary tools that we as librarians use to help people build knowledge, to help people create knowledge. The first is access. Now, I say that, every librarian cheers. Yes, that's us. And it's not just a matter of, yes, we got lots of stuff, we give access. And it's not just public access, that's really cool. And it's not even intellectual access and intellectual freedom, though those are all vital and important to it. Because access means access to knowledge, not just access to the tools and stuff. So how much time do you spend in your library connecting people to people? How much time do you spend in finding the right person for them to talk to, not the right book to read or right material? We're going to do this in a second. It'll be fun. And it's two-way. For too long, like millennia long, libraries have educated this way. What do I mean? Yeah. Now you guys have, I went to the special collections, you have a huge collection about Toronto history, you have a huge collection about Canadian history, so I'm going to give you a break. But a lot of libraries, particularly smaller branch libraries and public libraries, the way we do it is we bring in everything that's not us to educate our poor people behind us. Oh, we bought lots of computer books. Why? Well, because our community needs to learn how to use computers. We bought in lots of books on gardening. Why? Because our community needs to learn about gardening. No one gardens? Oh, what do you mean? Well, if someone wants to learn about gardening, could they talk to a gardener? If someone wants to learn about computers, can they talk to a computer programmer? Can you connect people that have common interests? We're going to get back to this one in a moment. And it's two ways. One of the things we talk about is how can libraries unleash the voice and knowledge and understanding of our communities to the rest of the world? For too long, we've looked at libraries as a gateway to the rest of the world. Now we need to look at them as a bullhorn to the rest of the world. Quick example, because I love fun stories. That's all I do is tell stories. Back to Vermont. In Vermont, they have this thing called snow. And it turns out if you want to get through snow quickly, you get skis and you attach a motor to it and it becomes a snowmobile, which in America is great because to you guys it's probably a means of conveyance. To us it's like motorcycles in the snow, right? So we just use it to kill ourselves. But this one gentleman throughout his life loved snowmobiles and he bought snowmobiles and he bought broken snowmobiles and he bought snowmobile parts and he ended up in retirement with a barn full of old dead snowmobiles behind his house, which I'm sure thrilled his wife to no end. His grandson came home from school one day and said, "Grandpa, do you mind if I take a camera and catalog all the broken snowmobiles and snowmobile parts you have?" And I'm sure his grandfather said something to the effect of, "Eh." Right? So off he went. Oh, maybe that's just my grandfather. Could we talk about, no. So he did. Okay, took pictures, cataloged, whatever. Put it online. And overnight, created a snowmobile parts distribution system worldwide. Why? Because it turns out that while everyone had their brand new snowmobiles around them, in Siberia, and I'm not making that up, Siberia, They had old snowmobile parts from the Soviet era, pre-Soviet era. They couldn't find the parts for it, so they started ordering it from the barn in Vermont. You have, somewhere in Toronto, brilliant people with a story to share. Snowmobile parts, understanding, ability to garden, new thoughts, native languages, history. How can they become, how can they come to the public library as a publisher of their story to the rest of the world? So that when people are ready to travel, why would I come to the Toronto Public Library if all I can find is travel materials about every place else? We learned this very early on in Syracuse when we recruit faculty, and faculty would sit down and we'd have to give them the why you want to, you know, come back, why you want to come to Syracuse story. And I realized I did this. I said, oh, we are 5 miles from Cleveland, Washington, D.C., Philadelphia, Montreal, Toronto, and Boston. We can, within a half a day, get to 75% of the entire population of the United States. And this person, without missing a beat, looked at me and said, so I should come to Syracuse because it's easy to leave? Oh. Travel section. How much is about Toronto travel? How much, when you have a tour guide that wants to come and give local tours and ghost tours and recreational tours and this tour, can I find that to the library? When I was in Syracuse planning my trip, could I come to the Toronto Public Library to see what I could do here, what I could be involved in? One of the beautiful things we saw was the idea that you're working with the theater community so that you can see the casting calls. Brilliant! I come here to learn about my community, from my community, share my community. This is about my community. Why should a library in Seattle, New York, Toronto Public Library, Syracuse, and Namibia look exactly the same? Well, how does it look, Dave? This will be radically unfamiliar to you. An information desk here, shelving here by Dewey. And the Dewey always has numbers, and then somewhere tucked away safely so they could break the code is the number to letter conversion chart. Like, why we couldn't just put the words in front of it? Anyway, because then we'd have to put up a sign. Signage. All right. Two-way. Do you have the, because I know you guys have the Starkitect, because it is a beautiful building. I say that in all honesty, beautiful building. I was in Vancouver that has the Coliseum-like thing. They get fined for every new sign they put up by the architect. Like, where's the men's room sign? Cost them like $100, so they would just rather people walk around like this? I mean, what is that? All right. So one, we provide access. Access not just to stuff and resources and that kindling of the mind, but access to people and individual and expertise. And we become the venue that we allow the rest of the world access to our communities and our uniqueness and our sense and our style. In downtown Philadelphia, they wanted to create a wonderful music collection. They wanted to work with musicians. They said, we're going to create a matchmaking service. And we got all these musicians and they said, all right, rock music, forget it. It's already happening. Country music, it's already happening in clubs and bars. But world music, classical music, there's no place to do it. And the ultimate sign of achievement and quality is to perform your great work. We want a stage. You want to know what the public library should look like to us? We want a stage. I noticed you pointed out you guys have piano rehearsal rooms up in the music area. Good for you. Right? And they said, we are absolutely thrilled if you record our performances and broadcast those out to the world. So could you imagine going to the Toronto Public Library to hear the Toronto sound, to hear what the community's developing, what they're thinking about? What's the unique Toronto cuisine? How is that getting out there, etc.? So we provide access. We provide knowledge. You great book, don't read English. Maybe we could provide some language training for you. Or, oh, you're doing a report in eighth grade? Here's a great physics journal that will help you, right? So I went through a little touch of the cancer. It was delightful. So far, so good. Regular recovery. And they would bring you with chemotherapy. If you ever have a chance, don't take chemotherapy. Right? Because quite literally, they put these toxins into you. One of them came from the spring apple blossom. Doesn't that sound nice? Spring apple blossom? Which is a lethal, poisonous root that Native Americans used to grind up to get rid of warts. Pumping through your body. The other one came from mustard gas. Mustard gas. World War I, trench warfare, Germans, mustard gas in my body. That's what they were putting. And what they would do is they would bring you the sheet, and one of the sheets was the patient sheet. And the head of the patient sheet said, what does this chemical do? kills cancer. Yay, right? I put that as a sarcastic tweet, and a friend of mine said, you would rather it tickles the cancer? All right, so fair enough. The nurses learned eventually to bring me the doctor's version of the sheet that would actually talk and break it down. When you have patients going through chemotherapy, when you have patients going through diagnoses, when you have, their doctor should help them with this. But you guys, I know on a regular basis, get people sitting at your desks and in your database going, are we going to be as helpful to the doctors where we simply go, Medline, good luck? Or are we going to work with nurses to bring nurses into it? In Cuyahoga County Public Library, their virtual reference service, not only could they send questions back and forth to their librarians, they could send them off to nurses at the local hospital so they could provide medical help. We'll get to that in a second, too. So more than question and answering, because that's the trick, right? Well, we'll get there. We provide a safe environment, physically safe environment, and intellectually safe environment. It's a safe place to access dangerous ideas. We do that by privacy. How much do you spend, show of hands, how much would you say that you have advised a patron at some point, maybe lots, that the information they give to the library is held as private or confidential information? Is, right? So we don't keep your searches, we don't keep your book history, right? Sounding familiar? Did you mention at any point that if they do that through an internet provider like Rogers or such, that that information's kept anyway? Yeah. Good for you. Did you ever tell them about the Tor network, which allows them to anonymize their traffic so that they can't be tracked back? Did you spend time talking about secure browsers? Right. This idea about what we provide in terms of in a safe environment, in too many cases, I've seen libraries that said, confidential personal information and never tell them that their internet service provider can track every keystroke they're doing. So we're giving them a false sense of privacy and security. Privacy is so important to us, we don't even want to have the discussion and the debate. We just say it is private. Have we had that discussion with our communities to say, you know, if you let us keep your circulation records, we can tell you if you read the damn book 3 years ago, instead of waiting till you get home and going, I read this damn book 3 years ago, right? But that's going to require a conversation. And motivation. Why are they here? So I want to do our first exercise. Our first exercise is on more than Q&A. And what I need for this exercise is I need a reference librarian. This is like the magic show. I will not saw you in half. Please come forward. A reference librarian. Thank you very much. And now... Now I need someone to pretend that you have a question, right? Because this is how we teach reference. Stick with me. Preferably not embarrassing. Or it could be embarrassing. We can all have fun with it. Question.
How can I help you?
See?
Oh, thanks for
all right, come on up. All right. Right? How many times do we have to say, you're not bothering me? It's my job. All right, so stay here. We are going to do a brief reference interaction. Please. He's asked how he can help you.
Hello. How can I help you?
Hello. I am a freelance software developer, and I am sick to death of having to run my own infrastructure to support sending emails. Sendmail is a pain in the ass to deal with. I know very little about these new cloud services that can send emails on the behalf of my web applications, but I would just like to... Do you have anything that I can use to do some research to understand this better? I'm quite traditional. I like to manage my own stuff. I don't really understand.
That's a great question. Thank you. Now, I know I can do that up here. Wouldn't you all wish you could do that somewhere? All right, we have a question.
So...
What would you do? All right, go ahead.
So, just to paraphrase back, you're looking for information on email and iCloud. Is that correct?
Sorry, on email and...
iCloud?
No.
Then I've not understood. Can you just tell me again what you're trying to find today?
I want to send emails with my applications that I'm developing as a software developer.
Okay.
But I don't want to have to manage the infrastructure for sending the emails. So I know from talking to friends of mine in the community that there are there are services that you can purchase on a subscription basis that you can use to send emails without having to manage the infrastructure yourself. I just don't know how to research them.
We can, so what I'm hearing is you're looking for a purchased email service. You're not quite sure in terms of how to manage it. And we can look in our catalog. Does that sound more close to what
that's
you're talking
about? That's closer to what I'm looking for, yeah.
Okay. So, okay. Well done, right? So,
wow. That was a tough one.
Yes. Right, right. Now, how many people have had that one? They're like, Joe James tells the story. He says his favorite referenced work is the statistical abstracts. He goes, because that's got everything in it. It just takes him a long time to make it through while you're sitting there going.
I should have asked the one that completely destroyed me as a new reference librarian about a decade ago, which was somebody asking me about how to build dams.
Okay. The one I heard was, do clams sleep? Took this woman, she tells the story, it took her 14 years and like going to Oceanographic Institute, and finally she got an oceanographer saying, well, they go through a dormant period. So anyway. Now, well done, because I'm, you know,
yeah.
When we teach reference, open-ended questioning, you're not cutting them off, you're having the reference interview, you're rephrasing to see if you get it right, you're going to clarification, eventually you go to resource back and forth. A lot of what we teach reference. What I'd like to show you is, what is the difference between what just happened here, well done, and a class?
Sorry, can you repeat that?
What is the difference between this transaction and what you might see in a classroom? So we're inquiry-driven, but otherwise...
There's no interaction in a class.
It depends on the classroom, but it's a fair point. What I'm trying to get... Thank you, Jim.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
Well done. Well done. What I would like to talk to you about, and this is my favorite slide title ever, is the greedy librarian problem and the potential death of the public library. The first thing for you to notice is what was happening there, or what you hope to happen as you get resources and materials, because that is, by the way, an evolution. What you're seeing is the latest incarnation and evolution of reference. If you go back in the history of reference, you get to the point, in 1968, a really brilliant gentleman named Robert Taylor wrote an article called Question Negotiation. Taylor in 68, it's like the seminal piece in reference. There are iSchool faculty that name pets Taylor 68. I mean, this is, right? And what Taylor did was he looked at reference librarians and he said, how do they do it? And they said, well, what they do is people start with what they call an unstated need. That is, you don't even know how to say what you just have this question, you can't form it. It's that thing that's bothering you. And when you finally get to saying it, it's what he called the compromised need. That is, it's the closest I could put into it, right? Particularly because think about what we ask people to do in a reference interaction. We ask people to do the antithetical thing to being human. We ask people to a stranger in public, admit ignorance. And we ask them to do it quickly. Right? And we assume that they even know the right words for something they don't understand. How many people have had the evil reference transaction where the person's sitting there going, this is simple, and you're sitting there going, no, it's not. Right? You're like on your 28th book going, cloud? What? Right? This happens all the time. Right? First thing to point out, it's a learning experience. That's what we're getting to, is the idea that what just happened was a very hyper-localized, very quick, very intensive teaching activity. They did set the topic. You're absolutely right. The person asking the question set the topic. But if that's teaching, that means things like learning style suddenly play into it. That means things like pedagogy suddenly leans into it. That means that suddenly, instead of just doing it one-on-one, I could do, you know, you three had the same question. Maybe we could just get together next Thursday and talk about it. And the future of reference isn't in trying to get our numbers to go up. The future of reference is instruction. The future and references, thank God we don't have to answer so many stupid directional questions, because we have so much important stuff to get people on, and it takes more than 5 minutes. It takes an hour in the teaching computer literacy skills. It takes getting experts in and bringing them from around the world. It's the idea of going out and teaching. The greedy librarian problem is something we discovered in virtual reference. And that was the idea that librarians hate to lose.
Yes.
And how does a reference librarian define losing? Having to ask for help on a question. Right? Now you're gonna. No, you're nice and honest. This is a Canadian audience because you're going. Yeah. In America, it's like. I would never lose like that. That'd be losing, right? No, it's a. If we put people in networks where they could literally take a question and they could seamlessly forward it off to other individuals electronically, right? So when you're in a face-to-face reference environment, it's hard to say, please wait, I've got to get, or no, someone's not working here. But in a digital environment, we set up the ability to quickly move questions around. It never happened. Reference librarians never wanted to give up a question. They would admit, I have no idea about this topic. And they would then spend an hour learning about the topic rather than forwarding it off to someone who knew the answer and could answer it quicker. Greedy librarian problem. How does this lead to the death of the public library? I'm going to walk you through this and then we'll take our break. So deep breath, we're almost there. I would argue that what we are facing now with the internet is a massive new influx of a new media type to our library collections, which is pretty special. Because if you go back 3000 BC, we actually added clay tablets. Probably a debate about storage, but we did it, right? Then, you know, we waited another 2000 years, and then we brought in the scroll, add joke about portable media here. Then nothing really happened for 2000 years. So in 1000, we added books and manuscripts. We waited about, you know, another 970 years, and we decided that paperbacks were finally able to be included. Does anyone live long enough to remember the idea that could we put paperbacks in a library collection?
I've read the article.
You've read the article, yes. I'm not gray enough to remember when we had the debates about fiction. I'm just going back to, oh, they'll fall apart, and they're tradebacks, and they're crap, and, you know. And then, oh, in 1980, we added tapes, and we've been ruining the day ever since VHS was invented, right? And then, you know, we got really accelerating 10 more years. We added CDs and online databases, and I would argue that right now, we're about to add a whole new kind of media type. We're about to add communities, all right? So stick with me on this metaphor for a moment, right? So what we know is that we have a community coming through the library to get some sort of resource. Now, we've already talked about, stick with me for a moment, this can be other community members and individuals, but for now, let's keep it relatively simple. We need to give ourselves, as librarians, an enormous pat on the back and a huge credit because over the past 2 decades, the library collections of has gone through a paradigm sea change of unprecedented proportions. Not a joke. We moved from just dealing with documents to the idea that we began to include different media type to then we began including databases. This was a massive shift. This was a, what do we do with the stuff and it falls apart? This was a, we're going to allow things into our library. We don't even know what we are allowing into our library. Think about that for a moment. We depended on publishers, we had select lists, we had acquisitions librarians, we had subject specialists. We get Elsevier, and they say, here's 100,000 articles, and we don't know what's in those articles. We don't know if there's any good. We don't know what's been retracted. We don't know who picked them. We don't know who indexed them. That was an amazing change that happened in our profession, and we need to give ourselves credit for that. Now, the internet came in. This is, I mean, Michael Gorman got up and said, information's free on the internet and you get what you pay for. Now we're like, this is what everyone's coming for. Right? It's back to that doctor. Right? This is now seen as part of our collection in broadcasting, in searching it, in making it available, in public access. Amazing shift. Once again, we should cheer ourselves. We're now beginning to add services. Language learning services, translation services, visualization services, 3D printing services. right? And so now, the service sector, the public access side, hasn't been just sitting around doing nothing. We've added a couple of things too, right? We've added instruction, so now we teach computer literacy skills. Everyone remember the phrase bibliographic instruction, or BI, right? You know, we've now realized that teaching people to be like little librarians is not the right way to go, right? So we learned you teach them about computers and such. We did reference, we've now added maker spaces. In some academic sectors, we do data management. Some public sectors, towns, we become town archives and data managers. We add help people with employment services, tutoring services. So we have added on the public service side an amazing array of collection, and we call it service. But what hasn't happened here is what had to happen here. What had to happen here was that we needed to understand these things as a new collection, as a new holistic framework to understand what a collection is. What's happening here is that we're adding stuff and hoping for the best. And worse, we're managing each one of them as if they're brand new and we're looking to find someone else who's done it. And even worse, we treat this service thing as a brick wall. That is, you are being served. You are a patron. You are the community. I am the librarian. I provide the service. I am in control. But it gets worse. Because in addition to these services, the next thing we've been doing is we haven't stopped, right? Because we started with these, and then it's like, well, I guess we could also do childcare, and well, there's startups, so we can do that in our business. And oh, people need to get continuing education, and we got to help them with admissions to college. And well, they need tax advice because now the tax services are going. Social services are important, and on and on and on. It's like if you're a reference librarian, every day is a new adventure because someone's had a great idea in Connecticut, and we've got to implement it here, right? In Wisconsin, they check out fishing rods. We've got a lake, right? But what's it? If he can't be informative, he can at least be amusing. All right. What's interesting about this, though, is why have we taken these on? I'm going to the positive way, not the, you know, herd mentality way. The positive way is because particularly in civil society, particularly in town government, municipal government, and federal government, what we have seen is a retreat of the service mentality and intermediated services. So where once you could get tax advice from someone who worked, what's the tax office called in Canada? Canada Revenue, thank you. You could call up and talk to a human being. Oh, that's too expensive. That's okay. We'll put up a website. So now everyone can get it, unless you don't have a computer, access to it, can't read English or anything else, or you get to the website and you didn't ask a question that they decided they had the answer for. Right? So what happened? Where did they go? To your library. And then, this just happened in the United States. We're trying to push everyone to do e-filing so they can get our money faster. They've decided they don't have the budget to print the forms for taxes. So if you want the form to do it by paper because you don't have computer literacy skills, walk with me. What do you have to do? Print the form from the computer you don't have the skills to use. Where do you go? The library. So what happens to the reference librarian? We're now tax experts. And we don't have any issues with social service. No, we don't deal with the mentally disabled on a regular basis because social services have been cut. We don't deal at all with testing services where for-profit universities ask us to proctor exams for them. How much money are we spending in bandwidth so that people can go to Phoenix University to get their degree? We don't deal at all with GEDs because our education system has failed to create alternate educational systems. We don't deal with childcare because the social service safety net has been cut on a regular basis. Yes, we do. I love youth services librarians, but even they will tell you they are not babysitters, and they really resent it when they get used as babysitters, right? So what's happened is, as municipal government has retreated, the public library, because we are genetically incapable of seeing the need and not trying to solve it. I was asked for directions today on Bloor Street. You've done this, haven't you? And you try and give them direct. It was a nun. A nun asked me for direction on Bloor Street. And I finally just had to say, ma'am, I'm sorry, I don't know. Okay? What this, the potential death, what this leads to? What this leads to is, first, a huge confusion in the mind of our communities as to what is a library and what isn't a library. We already know there's confusion about who a librarian is, right? If they walk in and there's someone in a tie, they're a librarian, regardless of whether they work there or not, right? So we've already had that confusion. Now we get the confusion of, why are you doing makerspaces and childcare and tax services, and you want me to spend my tax dollars to do language for new immigrants? Don't we have a social service for them? Right? And the best is, we're going to do it like crap. I hate to break it to you. I love you dearly. I'm guessing you guys, not tax experts. Right? So what's going to happen? One, if they know it happens in the library, they're going to begin to say, oh, typical, typical government service. Typical social service. I pay this tax dollars and they give me second-rate service. Close them. The other one is, no, it's okay. What we'll do is, we will hire a social worker. We will hire a tax expert. We will hire these people. And you see this in academic libraries. We'll hire a professor, an anthropologist, first as a librarian. And then what do? We put them in stovepipes. So when we hire these people, we bring them into the library, do we turn them into librarians? Or do we simply say, oh, that's the tax office over there? So we create stovepipe services. So this service wall that we build creates a diffuse concept of the library. We become jack of all trades and master of none, or we become overloaded on what you guys are supposed to know. Right? Or we create this inelegant combination of professionals where we simply exist under the same roof but have not the same service philosophy, same values, same understandings. How many times have you talked to about a potential technology solution, or had an entrepreneur or technologist come up to your library and say, you know what you could do? You could do this. When they walk in with their phone, I can track them to exactly what book they touched. And they say it with relish, and you react with horror. Right? My God. But guess what happens when you go shopping at Bays and such? They know exactly where you are and what you're doing, and they do. Right? But we don't want that in our library. But if we hire a technology consultant or bring in a technology service and we do not instill our values of intellectual honesty, of intellectual freedom, we will create a situation where we imperil our own citizens because we haven't had that conversation. This is what will kill public libraries. What will happen is, in the short term, we'll feel really special. We'll see more and more people coming in. We'll even see revenue coming in because tax service doesn't have to pay for it. They'll pay for us a small amount. We'll feel good. Life is good. People are coming in. We're getting lots of questions. Yay, yay, yay. And then suddenly it will all crash around us as we are left in a diffuse muddle of individuals providing second-rate service on very important things with our community. Thank you. There we go. No. Almost done. So what's the solution, Dave? I'm glad you asked. The solution is, this is built on a model of, I know you don't. Me, librarian, smart. You, citizen, ignorant. I didn't say stupid. Ignorant means hasn't been taught yet. Anyway, that's how we do it. You have a question about cloud computing and not hosting your own server, you are suddenly about to become a cloud expert. Right? And we're all going to go like this, right? And I love you. I have no doubt you are the best reference librarian ever. I do have questions about your ability to guide them through setting up a hosted cloud service for email. Send them to Hillary Clinton. All right. An American joke. It worked. The answer to this problem is guess who does have a tax expert? And guess who does have a gardener? And guess who does have social services? You have that question? Let's find someone who can answer it. Let's not pretend that this is somehow some stupid, uneducated masses who only come to our desk when they're confused or stuck. You're in Toronto. You have scientists walking through, you have authors walking through, you probably have a Nobel laureate or two who stops by every so often. You have bakers, you have tax experts, you have accountants, you have realtors. You have the brilliance of a world-class city before you. It would be unethical not to tap that as your true collection. That's the collection that we can now tap to get answers. So we are going to take a break, and we are going to come back, and we are going to talk about how to tap that expertise. So, can I give them 10? Is 10 all right?
10 minutes.
10 minutes. So come back at 10 of, and we will solve all the world's problems. And I will turn off the microphone so I'm not broadcasting to the world. I'm fine.
You're good?
Fine.
All right. Water okay? You're
yeah,
good?
Doing okay. Fine. Is everyone doing okay?
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah. Perfect.
Yeah.
Time's
flying.
It's fine. It's very interesting.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I'm lecturing a little bit more than I thought I would. I apologize for that.
No, it's great.
It's right tone.
Okay.
It's great.
Right,
yeah.
Right tempo, everything is good.
Okay.
Good. Yeah. Can I get you a coffee or anything?
No,
or
really.
Tea?
No, really. I'm easy. Thank you.
No. I just, you know.
You're like an Italian mother. Eat.
Yeah.
Mangia.
Okay. All right.
All right. Okay. I'm just going to step aside for a second myself.
Hello.
Hi there.
All
wrapped up.
Doing well?
Yeah.
Good.
I have radiation oncology team, even though I don't need radiation, but I met with them this morning, and they went through the business about why I don't need that.
I agree.
Yeah, I'm incredibly well looked after. You were when you wrote to me about this, when I said what's going on, you said this is a club that nobody wants to join, but you will find that you are bathed in love. I can't remember how you said. I keep saying this with the luxury of a good prognosis.
Yes.
But that is exactly
good.
It strengthens you and everybody around you.
It's interesting.
Dramatic.
Yeah. Airborne.
Good. I'm glad.
What do you mean that?
Thank you for the feedback on the draft. So I should be writing a lot more, but I'll be desperately writing on the train back. So.
Oh.
It's not going to get in on time. We'll show progress.
So, I mean, Ken and I have had a whole conversation because we don't even mention the overdue book. You know, publishers seem to be a forbearing
lot.
Yes,
they are. So today's, believe it or not, this is the practical stuff.
Yes.
And then tomorrow was the we'll dive into unbiasedness. So.
Okay. Anything you want me or don't want me to say, introducing you, maybe
just
I should
short.
Just come out. Yeah.
Just be sure. That's all I ask.
So we can introduce this thing. This event is so formal that they're introducing me to introduce you.
Yeah.
I had to supply a tie over this thing.
I did bring the tie and the jacket. I will dress up.
I've got a suit.
Oh, there you go.
Very problematic. I've been so several years ago, I had they provide a bit of provincial. We have state libraries here, but
right.
But they're provincial oversight mechanism. And I think I want to break that up for the UK people. I've got a group in the UK who are involved in the group, and some of them are not involved in the group, they're involved in the discussion. Some of the UK stuff is sort of a legacy of the US, which I just don't think on this side of the pond we'll ever truly understand. And another part of it is a certain amount of if they don't play our game by our rules, they're the devil incarnate and they won't have anything to do with any of us. And that's kind of the libraries in the UK. You know, we're far too pure to talk to those devils.
So when the Siege Harp report came out, it said more or less we need bathrooms and Wi-Fi. But what it really said was we need inviting spaces that people want to go to. Just a flood of negativity. It won't change anything. They're not fund at all. You hate stuff about the book. Yeah, right. The poor farmer doesn't need the well-selected proper literature.
Well, and I have a friend who just worked here last year, but in reference, do not waste your breath. This is so ingrained. And they have been running these little schools for years. They just don't have the big scale cooperatives that speak like progressive generations of and the fact that they are also direct employees of the
government.
So when we've got this little fighting force, and you know, open the door and giving some deep clueless people.
I went for the week, so I skied later that day. I took the next part half day off.
And you looked exactly effortless, but you could be in speaking online that really
The trick is not to think of it as a camera, but pretend you're doing a Skype session.
Yeah, conversation.
With just one other person, and you look right through the camera at them as opposed to on your screen.
I'm not going to try again. Do you know Heather Mathis?
Yes. It's on my welcoming
Sorry, I'm hugging.
No, it's okay. I'm smiling as I'm listening. My dad was a librarian. He worked as a librarian.
not for his whole career, but for a chunk of time. When I became a librarian, he said to me, now, one thing about reference, he says, the best way to answer a question you don't know the answer to is to find the person who does know the answer.
Oh, good.
I was talking to him this past week, and he's well retired at this point, but always interested in librarianship, and I said, well, this person was the lecturer. I can't wait to tell him what you were talking about today. He's going to find that he resonates so well.
Good.
So,
good. Everything old is new again.
I mean, it's really important. And I'm really interested to hear what you're going to say next.
Yeah.
It's a big city and how you draw it all together and make it work. It's quite quick.
Scale is an issue.
Well, but at the same time, there's a reason you have 99 branches, right?
Yeah,
exactly. We're everywhere in a lot of ways.
Yeah, and so it should allow... Those 99 branches should not look like all each other.
Don't, if you
want to hear from
some of them are designated historic buildings that they have reworked sensitively to raise the space.
And they work in really good communities in different ways. You really need to do that.
All right, well, let's see if we can get people back in. I'm sure we lost half. That's what always happens.
Are you? Yes, you're ushering people in that way. Yes.
It's a running joke with my family about when we came up to Toronto in December. So for fun, as I've been walking by them, I've been taking pictures, sending them to my son. Here we go. Yes, we do. Well, and now they're more concerned by burger people, so yeah.
It looks different. It's not the same anymore. It feels different.
It's a shame.
Yeah. You're starting to introduce them into the restaurants and the restaurants. And the end result is not what it does before.
I was so thrilled because I was out last night in front of a big bottle of water. They had bars of Macintosh coffee. So there's a lot of that coming back. It was, well, and see, that's the thing is, when I grew up, my father used to fly to Niagara Falls and grew up in. We come on the Canadian side and we're getting Macintosh coffee. But it wasn't until a few years ago that someone said, so it's a new difference. In the freezer. Eat pieces. Oh, it's so much more. That would have saved so many fillings.
I know, I was about to say that.
Yeah. All right, thank you. We can gather. I always. I know we always do.
Ready to start again, everyone?
So, as always, during the break, you lose half the group of Tim Hortons, so... I have a half an hour to solve all these problems.
You know everything.
I know everything. I'm a good reference librarian. Curfew shall not come tonight. There. Okay. How many people know what this is? Anyone?
This is dessert I had at a very expensive restaurant. Electric toothbrush.
I would feel very sorry for you. Electric toothbrush, a dessert, anyone?
A brush bot,
also called a bristle bot. And so this is the classic makerspace do-it-yourself gateway drug for young children. What you do is you take a toothbrush and you clip off the bristles, and on top you attach a battery, and a motor from a pager. Remember we used to have those things? And so what happens is a pager motor is just a quick electric motor that spins a weight. And that makes the vibration sense that you get in your phone. And by the way, if you ever have the phantom vibrations where you just feel like it did, that's actually a clinical thing now. So it's not just you. So the idea is you take a BristleBot, you put it with a battery, you put on this motor, you connect it, and it goes, and it vibrates, and so therefore it moves through the table and whatever. And then what they do is you get together with kids, and they have races with them, and you have mazes and tracks, and they made it themselves. They made a robot. So one year, a library near me said, we're going to do BristleBots. I brought my six-year-old son. We cut off we had a great time cutting off the bristles. We put on the tape. We put it all together. We attached the battery, and the BristleBot went, did another one, did another one, panic, right? What had happened is the librarians preparing this program had bought the wrong batteries. And these bristle, those pager batteries actually take a fair chunk of power. And so they had a lot of equipment for about 10, you know, about 5 seconds worth of bristle botting. And so there were three librarians, and you could just see them all race to a corner. And they all were sitting there going, like, things like, I don't know, can we get more batteries? Who wants to get the battery? Do we need a purchase order to get the battery? I don't know. Can I do it out of the budget? Do we have the budget? Meanwhile, and I'm watching all of this, equally terrified, because now I have a six-year-old who's bored, and oh, good God. They're like, the six-year-olds, there were maybe six of them, right? So they almost they barely outnumbered the librarians. There's something like, has anyone got a AA battery? Yeah, let's see if a AA battery. Oh, but that's too big for the bristle. Let's put it on the toothbrush. Oh, duct tape? Yeah. And they're like duct taping like toothbrushes to get, they got like bristle tanks and bristle aircraft carriers and like throwing bristle bots. And just like this instant, the librarians looked at the kids. I looked at the kids. The librarians and I looked at each other and we just both went, oh, that's what learning's supposed to look like, right? The librarians were terrified because it was a library program. Therefore, they were the teachers, back to that little conversation, and they should have all the solutions. But when they saw that the kids were developing their own solutions, they realized this was more authentic, more interesting to the kids, and ultimately more interesting to them as librarians because they could see that it was a much more rewarding experience. This library totally, not just based on this event, but one of these events, realized that they had screwed up for years their library volunteer program. And you're going, how do BristleBots and library volunteers? This is how. The library volunteers used to be, I'm going to volunteer at the library. My job is to help the librarian do their job. So I'm going to shelve, and I'm going to put them in crates, and I'm going to put barcodes on here, and I'm going to do a story time every so often. They realize with this and that it's the other way around, that when people volunteer their time at the library, it's the librarian's job to help the community member share what they know. They said, we're taking in personal finance managers, we're taking in lawyers, we're taking in yoga experts, we're taking in cooks and chefs, and we're trying to turn them into mini librarians when what our community is begging for is access to financial advice and yoga advice and cooking advice, and just buying the book isn't enough. And so they have a makerspace. Here it is. If you look in the back, you have the obligatory male with the headphones. You have the 3D maker bots, and then you have these girls sitting here doing other things. The makerspace became a place where not only did they do 3D printing, but they began doing construction. If I could turn the camera around, you'd be looking at a wall of hand tools. Because what they did is they had contractors come in and say, I'm perfectly willing to teach about home repair and not getting yourself electrocuted to change a light bulb. And they began offering courses. If I turn the camera this way, they have 8 programmable sewing machines. These librarians, who I love, many of which I had in class, when one of these breaks down, when they have the PVC has plugged up the thermal emitter, they don't blink an eye. They look at these sewing machines and they melt because they are terrified of them, right? So what happens is the community comes in and teaches sewing, and they have sewing groups, and they do workshops, and they do all these other things. They realized that this was so powerful that not only did they want to provide a makerspace that did the tech, yes, they got laser print, laser etchers, and they got linoleum cutters and cool stuff, but then they said, what about the little kids? The little kids are really good at ideas, and so what they did was they created a corner of the library they call the Little Makers Area. They take broken watch parts, they take cardboard, they take construction paper and glue, and they make their own creations, and they, other than the word little maker, curate this entire corner where 8-year-olds and 6-year-olds go in and decide what's been up there long enough and what should go up and change. When they get too old for the mini maker spaces, what they begin doing is they move into the tween area. And they have youth services librarians that, yes, can talk about, yes, you should read Hunger Games, and yes, you can do this, but also talk about robotics competition and Lego competitions. And they begin building and competing in national competitions about these ideas where kids are engaged. When they get a little older still, they work in Minecraft areas. So they, Minecraft, if you haven't experienced it, you have not touched might be the wrong word, you have not interacted with a 13-year-old recently. Minecraft is Legos online, and it's really cool. And so what they did is they built this, it's like Legos, you build it in space, but you have lots of different people, and they all work in it. And they said, we're going to have Lego Minecraft competitions. So they built a space, and they all did capture the flag. After the first one, these teens went up to the librarians who put it together and said, that sucked. You know, because teens lack vitamin brain. But they said, I have a teenager, I'm allowed to say that. They said, that sucked. They said, you didn't use this mod, and you didn't do this, and the teens without missing a beat, or the librarians without missing a beat, said, next time you're building the world. And so now they have monthly competitions where the teens not only compete and come and play and work in spaces, they come a week before where they begin designing the spaces and the competition and the rules. Eli Nyberger has an incredible program of gaming that goes on at the Ann Arbor District Library. He said it used to be that the library was a net detractor of social capital. In other words, don't let anyone see me in the library. They began offering competitions where they would do Mario Kart and video game competitions, and they began posting leaderboards, and it got to the point where now teens were dragging their friends either online or in person and saying, look, I'm the best. It became a net provider of social capital. And then when the teens are done in their Minecraft area, they have a production studio. They took a small tutoring room, painted one room with green so they can do green screen effects. They have cameras, they have Photoshop, they have video editing. And what it turned into was an amazing intergenerational connection where what happened was the parents would come in, they'd drop their little makers off, go into the back area where they would be prototyping new devices and new tools on the 3D printer, bring them to teens who would produce videos that they would put on Kickstarter to start their crowdsourcing campaigns. They said, yes, we do reading. Yes, we do reading club. Yes, we do video distribution. But everyone who enters into this library is a maker. Whether you are making a 3D printed object or whether you're making a new idea or whether you're making a connection, you're all makers. And where did this all come from? This all came from a simple little form. A simple little form. Question number one. So you go use a 3D printer. After you're done, they hand you this form. You go borrow a Kindle. You return it, they give you this form. You go and you read a book, they give you this form. What do you love to do? Question one. Question number two, what are you passionate about? They said they got some raised eyebrows about that one. And then the question number three, would you be interested in sharing what you know / teaching it to your neighbors / to the community? And this one little form has led to things like the sewing and knitting I talked about before. Civil War lectures, you know, the Battle of the States. So they have people interested in Civil War. They come and they have discussions on this. Community gardening. There was one library that said, we had all these people coming asking about gardening. And I could hand them a book by gardening, but then I sort of looked to my left and realized we have a yard attached to our library. And they bought a hose. And they created plots for community gardens. And what was amazing is they brought expert gardeners in, they brought amateur gardeners, people in, you know, cities that didn't have a yard, and they gave them space. And when it came August and September and those tomatoes started rolling in, They began having conversations about local food sourcing and food pantries. They brought in people to talk about how to make tomato sauce. All of this came from the simple task of, I want to learn how to garden. Right? We had Legos and robotic competition, digital video gaming tournaments, all of this. So here's my question. We got 30 minutes. Let's do this. What's your passion? So you ready? 5 minutes to talk to your neighbor. Make it 3 minutes because, you know, passions don't take long. Turn to your neighbor and share a passion that you have that you're willing to go public with. All right? Now. And I'm not going to force you to come up to the room. I need a volunteer for someone, a passion that you heard about that you would like to share. Yeah.
I have a passion for fashion. I have passion for fashion.
Okay. Fashion.
Yeah.
All right. So let's take a moment and ask the second question, which is if we had someone with a passion for fashion, how would we utilize that expertise in one of our library settings? Thoughts?
How did you know it's real expertise?
Get there in a second. It's a great question. I'm going to write it here.
What does real mean?
We're going to get to that in a second. Because that's absolutely an important and essential question. All right. Yes?
Invite a fashion designer.
Now, here's a question. Why not, and I'm asking this as just a prompt. Why not also invite the person with the passion?
Yeah, no, I mean everybody.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Right, but so the idea being, and when you say invite them to do what?
To share
runway.
Ideas.
Wait.
Have a runway.
All right, so a runway show. All right, what else?
Well,
invite a videographer.
Okay.
Can I add something?
Please.
I think that this could be organized as some sort of a running series
okay.
of fashion, because it's such a disputable type of expression.
I'm with you so far. Give me a task. Give me an activity.
In library settings or amongst librarians. So I would definitely go to the social aspect of fashion.
Okay.
And then move on towards how to fashion. What is a fashion?
Give me something to do. I'm an American. I'm impatient and I want to fix it. Let's go.
Clothing
exchange.
Yeah. Oh, that's a good one. Yeah,
What else?
Get your colors done.
I think I'm a winter. I could be wrong. Yes.
I would say also connect to Fashion Toronto, the week-long fashion.
Yes. Because here's the other trick to using your community.
Yeah, model making.
You have a network, right? Real quickly, I have way too.
And how would we sell it? Should we just do it in the library settings, or should we go outside and meet?
So I had this wonderful librarian, and she was in a very small library, and they had a request to do square dancing. So she said, I organized a square dance. And she goes, it was too small into the library. It turns out down the street was an ice rink. Now, just take a moment. There you go. And then turns out they didn't do it on the ice rink. They had it in great time, whatever. She came back in the next day. You know what her coworker said? What was that? She goes, it was a library program. They said, no, it wasn't. Why? It wasn't in the library. Can we just agree never to say that? That we are the library, and where we go and we're serving our community, that's a library. I know it sounds terribly like a Christian mass, but work with it.
Whenever two or more of you gather, a library is there. Right?
So, looking at the time, give me another passion.
Hackathon.
Hackathon. All right, so what's the passion behind a hackathon?
To be like the fashion hackathon.
No, we're done with fashion.
I want a new idea.
Right, what's that?
New idea?
New idea.
Okay, baking.
Baking. Here, we'll even make. I'm remembering this. You'll keep me honest. By the way, do you guys have smelling markers where you are so that every time you pick up a marker, you go. You can always tell the kids of the 80s because they're looking for blueberry. All right. Baking. Give me a baking one. What programs can we do in baking? I'll give you the first one. Circulating baking pan collection. How many people had that damn kid who had to have an Elmo cake when he was in third grade? And when he was in fourth grade, doesn't like Elmo anymore, right? There's only so many ways you can make Elmo look like something else, right? This happened so many times that a bunch of parents got together and said, here, I've got an Elmo. Here, I've got Dora. Here, I've got a one. Here, and they brought it to the library, and the library created a circulating baking pan collection. And then they started bringing in the bakeware, and then they started talking about baking, and et cetera. Give me some others.
Icing.
Like
different types of icings.
Okay, all right, so we have tastings. Ooh, I'll come to that. Right?
Breakfast Club.
Breakfast Club! Yay! Where not only do they come and complain, they taste and eat. All right. Love it. Exactly. Ferguson, Missouri. You might have heard of it recently. Ferguson, Missouri was where a white cop killed an unarmed black man and started amazing race riots. I do not want to undervalue the strife and just discord and pain that community went through. Apparently someone tried to escape.
It's the controversial topic alarm.
Oh, no, I didn't. In Ferguson, I won't give you the full story, but it comes down to this. In Ferguson, besides the race riots, they closed just about every city function and government, including the schools. Why this matters is that in Ferguson, that had a large percentage of the youth population in underserved, under-economically developed areas, kids received additional food through free lunch. So not only were these kids stuck at home in the middle of riots, hearing gunfire and hearing explosion of tear gas late in the night, they were hungry. And what happened at Ferguson Public Library, what happened at the St. Louis County Public Library, is they opened. Now, the first thing they did is they opened. You have to understand that if the city librarian called the mayor and said, I'm thinking maybe not today for story time, he would have been given a pass. But they opened. And that's a choice.
And that's a choice, not of a library and not of a building and not of a policy. That was a choice of a librarian and a person to make a difference. And when they opened, they didn't just open to distract. They opened and they invited the teachers and they opened class in the libraries. When they ran out of room in the libraries, they started occupying churches because, and they started having museums, bringing in programs. They had magicians bringing back programs, and they had food services come in. Now, what's amazing is these food pantries and these food services were already there. All summer, they used the library as a way of distributing food. What happened was Ferguson's library changed the narrative of race riots to "we are all a family." Changed it from bad black people and evil white cops to a community dealing with stress and civil unrest, and our community isn't that different from Syracuse, New York, it isn't that different. Changed it. And they served that community, and they could only do it because they noticed who was down the street from them. The museum didn't show up because they just got the call that day. They had regular contact with them. It's a network you need to keep building and maintaining and bringing in and connecting. Just because I'm worried about time and I'm sorry I talk too much, but I wanted to take on your question because it is essential, which is, this is great, Dave, we love it, but what if they're crap? What if they don't know anything about fashion? What if they can't speak? What if they, you know, they think they can and they just go on for 3 days? Or what is their expertise anyway? Just like we used to do collection development with the stuff on our shelves, we have to do collection development with the people in our communities. They come in. How do I know that what they know? How am I going to vet them? How am I going to team them with other community members to make sure they have this expertise? If they come in and they're really horrible in front of crowds, they don't want to be in front of crowds. How can I find them other tasks to do? There was a group that came into a library and said, I'm very interested in early pre-literacy skills. I want people to be get skills before they even start to read. So there are things like books equal words and things like that. This person said, I don't want to be in front of a crowd, but I'm willing to put together a lesson plan for parents. So you can go check out a kit. The kit has this lesson plan. It has a board book with motion, and it has a toy for the toddler to play with, which is like roll it out and it rolls back. So that turned into a collection and not a series of speaking events. In Ferguson, it turned into hosted. I'll give you another one. In Cazenovia, New York, which is a very rich little suburban village in the poorest county in New York, right? They came in and they started realizing if they want to do library service, they need to actually go to the food pantry to do it. And they went to the food pantry and they did something which sounds so frighteningly traditional, you almost, you know, is that or is it cool enough to say? They brought new books with them. And they told the story. Betsy Kennedy, the director, told the story about when she took a new book and she handed it to a girl. The girl started crying. And when she asked why did she start crying, she said, it's the first new thing I have ever owned. That book wasn't about reading. That book wasn't even about knowledge. That book was about importance. And when they did that and they started working with the kids, they realized that the parents coming to pick up the food weren't doing so well either, so they began GED programs. They began high school education and continuing education programs. And when they ran out of room and realized the need throughout the county, they started working with churches around the county to start doing these tasks as well. Community collection development. What's their expertise? Do we know it? What skills? Because as I may come in as a great expert in self-publishing, but I need to learn presentation skills or organizational skills. Maybe we'll have you do this collection over here. Maybe we'll have you, teenager, build a Minecraft site because that's your expertise and where you gain value. Ultimately, what we're talking about is when we talk about defining a library, we must begin by defining what librarians are. What is a librarian? A librarian is someone with a mission. A mission of librarians is to improve society. And how do we do it? By facilitating knowledge creation in our communities. We do that by giving them access to books, but we also do that by giving them a platform and getting them to conversations where they learn. We do it by valuing their expertise, showcasing their expertise, and demonstrating that expertise. But that's not enough. Just having the mission's not enough. That's the mission of a teacher and a publisher and lots of people. It's our mission with our tools of facilitation that we talked about before. And that's not enough. It's our mission with these means of facilitation with our underlying values. We value learning, but we also value openness and transparency. We value intellectual freedom and safety. We value intellectual honesty. Come tomorrow to the University of Toronto, and we're going to talk a lot about being biased and unbiased. But these are values that we bring every day to what we do. What kind of skills do we need? This is a group that came out of a Salzburg summit, and they said, here are the skills that librarians need. The first skill is transformative social engagement. What that means is recognize that when you do your job, a community is changed because of it. Whether you like it or not, whether you tried to or not, simply being employed as a librarian or library worker in the Public Library of Toronto, you have changed your community. You took tax dollars that could have gone elsewhere. You took space that could have been redeveloped elsewise. You presented and took people's time. You changed it. We better make sure that changes for the better. And so what we need to realize is, as professionals, we are here to improve our communities, which is not unbiased and is not neutral and is not objective. If you believe that a community that knows more is a better community, you have a bias. And it's a good one, right? And understand that your community has needs. It's really easy to do the "you don't read well," right? You need more literacy in your life, right? You don't get out enough. You need to bathe. Whatever it is. Libraries, for too long, have approached our communities as this bag of faults that we're here to fix. Oh, we're going to fix literacy because we don't have enough people reading. Oh, we're going to fix boredom so we'll give you enough books. Oh, we're going to fix economic development because you need more money in your community. Do you know how often you like talking to people who remind you of your faults all the time? This is how we approach our community. What we need to approach our community is understanding their needs and aspirations. Ask them what their dreams are. Ask them what they want to be. Do we want to be a noble community? Do we want to be a literate community? Do we want to be a community that values diversity? How do we make that happen? And we have a community that has skills that we need to unleash with the rest of the community, not simply treat them as they only walk into our doors when they have a question. We treat them as a question. We give them a shot of an answer and hope for the best. We're building lifelong, engaged relationships with our communities to transform them for the better. Yes, we need technology skills. How do we look at our online site, not as an extra and not as a bulletin board, but as a branch and as a place for collaboration and as a place where people can work? When people come online and they search the databases at the Toronto Public Library, can they bookmark them and come back later to them? Mm-hmm. Good. Because they can't at Syracuse. Right? Because why? Our vendors don't let us. They work for us. Right? This idea that we go online and somehow it just becomes a consumption. Stop thinking of your community as consumers. Stop calling them users. Oh, please stop calling them users. Right? Why? I use people for a living. Right? What's your job? I get used. People come and use me and discard me. Is that really? Computer programmers and drug dealers have users. Let's not join that consortium. They're community members. And by the way, let's call them neighbors. Let's call them David. Let's call them by their name. Let's call them residents. Let's call them whatever, but they're not consumers because we're not teaching people to sit at a couch and Netflix the world away with the equivalent of the books. We're not looking to create passivity. We're not looking to create people who simply sit back and take whatever's thrown at them. We're looking to create people who govern themselves. We are looking at the basis of democratic participation. We are swimming against a very powerful stream, folks. Public libraries say something about the world that is different from Apple saying, here's a watch. Get my watch. Why? Because then you can buy my apps. And when you buy my apps, you get my content. Can I make an app? Not with the watch. The next time someone says, we don't need good internet connection because everyone has one of these, ask them how many apps have ever been written on an iPhone. You can't do it. If you're providing this level of access to technology, you are providing a consumption vehicle, not a creation vehicle. You are not unleashing your community. You are tying them into a walled garden, and they should at least know it before they make that decision. Management for participation. How do you deal with the collaboration? How do you not get terrified when you work with a community? I had one librarian said, the hardest thing I ever did was that I was so used to dealing with the community sits on that side of the desk and I sit on this side of the desk. The hardest thing I ever did was this. And I sat with them. How many times do you sit with your community, respecting them, showing the admiration, and believing that they have something to teach you as much as you have to show and share with them? Asset management, including living assets. It's not just the stuff, it's people. It sounds like Soylent Green. It's people, right? I'm astounded by my neighbors. I'm astounded by what they know, their world experience, their life experience. That's what I want to get out of Toronto, not what you bought, and usually bought about other places. It's cultural skills, realizing what communication happens differently with different neighborhoods, different backgrounds, different cultures, supports for multiple literacy. You know, we know that, for example, traditionally underserved populations, traditionally underserved urban populations, they communicate a lot with technology, smartphones, but they don't use them like other folks. They use them, and this is radical, to talk to people, right? As this was once put to me by the president of the American or the Italian Library Association. He said, in America, when you learn to make sauce, you go get a cookbook. In Italy, you ask your mother. He goes, there's lots of oral cultures out there where this, what they do is they pick up and they learn more from their cousins and their second cousins and their cousins of cousins. My wife's Italian. We have so many cousins, I can't even tell you. Right? We literally went to Australia and she has cousins. And I walked back with shoes. It was great. Right? How do we work with this? Well, the answer is you don't walk into a predominantly oral culture that has built a traditional network based on peer-to-peer connections and go, look, I'm going to improve you. Read this. There was a community college, had a brilliant, brilliant tutoring service. They had lots of people where it was the first time these folks were going to college. And they had a lot of remediation to do on basic mathematics, study habits, the whole thing. And they built this great system where you could come in to the joint library education area, and you get tutoring support. Turns out this community college served a U.S. military base, was one of their major draws, and so they had a large population that was being deployed overseas. So they tried to move all their tutoring online, and suddenly the effectiveness shot through the floor. And it wasn't because they didn't have time. It was because they took a culture that was used to talking to people, looking at people, interacting and trusting people, and they put them in front of computer screens with text. And they wondered why they couldn't make that adjustment. Just because you are book people, it's not a bad thing. Just because you know how to absorb and read from text, realize the ability to pick up a book and get and learn something from it is a superpower that isn't ingrained in you at birth. We have a good part of the GDP of Canada and the US is devoted to teaching people how to use a technology called a book. We call it formal education and reading. Think about the amazing amount of time we take kids, vulnerable children at age 5, and force them to age 18 to learn nothing but how to learn and absorb from books. And we're somehow startled that people who haven't had that have trouble when we say, didn't you read the tax form online? And they're like, no, I don't do that. That's power that you have. That's the other thing you've got to realize is that a librarian, you have power. You are powerful people. The community has vested you with power. You have, through your degrees and efforts, built up power. If you wish to empower other people, you must be powerful to do it. You cannot teach someone to read unless you know how to read. You cannot save someone from poverty unless you have access to the tools and knowledge of how to do it. And if you don't, you better find someone who does and have a on ready, rapid dial. Knowledge, learning, innovation, it all comes down to this. Community. The future will not be built by engaging a community. Community engagement, and I apologize for the community engagement person, it's not this sort of icing on top of a cake. Hi. But I think you'll agree. It's not something where you go, let's do everything we're doing. The community's coming. Send the community engagement person, right? You know, that's not it. It's not about engaging a community or reaching out to the community. It's by being the community directly. You want a good budget passed. You want resources. You want expertise. You want participation. You want respect. Then you better be my neighbor and my friend and my confidant, and you better know about my life, and you better be in my life where I am, the conversation I'm having. The future of a community is better defined by its aspirations than its deficiency. And ultimately, the community is your collection. Thank you very much. I took all the time I had. I apologize. What's so interactive?